Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I'm a writer, actor, and comedian. You may know me from Welcome to Flatch and Gaslit. Our guest today is Chelsea Pope. She is an actor, comedian, and content creator based in LA. She co-hosts the podcast A Breath of Fresh Movie and is an alum of the Groundlings Sunday Company. You can follow her everywhere at Chelsea the Pope. Hi.
Hi, hi.
What are you reading these days?
Oh my God. Okay, so I finally started Jeanette McCurdy's I'm Glad My Mom Died.
Ooh.
Have you read it?
No, it's
No.
been like looming too big, you know?
Yeah,
Like I don't know
it's
if I'm
like
ready.
it's been so in the zeitgeist. I mean, I kept coming across TikToks from the audiobook, and then my podcast buddy Victoria, she just like loaned me a copy of it, and I've gone through the first couple, like these little vignettes, and I got through like the first couple so far, and I'm like, oh my God, this is hitting. This is like a combination of like this is hitting close to home, the unstable, the mom that's sort of like she her mom projects all of this like emotional weight onto her. She's like, you're so lucky. I wanted to do this growing up, but I could they wouldn't let me. You're so lucky you have a mom. Like, I was, oh God, like just how deep the I just I know the rabbit hole's gonna keep going deeper. But it's very engaging. I really like the way she has a good sense of humor. She's it's self-deprecating, but not to the point. I mean it's uncomfortable, but she has a sense of humor about it, which like I mean, you know, you'd have to, or it's just like way too sad. So, yeah,
Oh man.
there
That's
you
a
go.
yeah. I mean, speaking of tough books, the book you picked for today is Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Sorry about that.
No. Oh my gosh. I had never read it before. What an incredible book. I mean,
It had a really big impact on me when I read it in high school, and got to say, I was looking at like the other books that you've talked about in your podcast with folks and then seeing the list. And then I saw that book. I'm like, oh, this one's a little heavier fare. Not like Amelia Bedelia, but you know what I mean? Like some of the other, I was like, should I reach like further back? You know, like should I pick like Babar or something? I don't know. But this one had the most impact on me in high school. I took AP English. And then when I did the test, I wrote on this book, and we actually hadn't studied it in the class. I was mostly skipping, not always skipping Miss Favre's class, but like I was also a TA for my freshman honors English teacher who also taught college prep English lit, and they were reading Cuckoo's Nest. And I remember thinking like, man, we got shafted. We were more or less kind of being coached or trained in these AP classes to learn what will be tested on for the AP course. Did you do AP stuff?
You're
Yeah.
absolutely right.
Right. And I know Miss Favre was well-meaning, and she had a good syllabus, but I just really didn't take to Invisible Man or The Awakening. I'm trying to remember what else we had read in that class, but not that I mean those are great works of literature, like don't get me wrong, but Cuckoo's Nest just resonated, and it was from my favorite teacher in school, and I was listening to him teaching it to the other, you know, my peers, and I'm like, this is like it's so edgy and anti-authority, and that's got a lot of nostalgic value.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were a senior, right? Reading
I
it,
was
working for this TA or as a TA.
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Man. And so how were you like a part of that? Like, I mean, you were teacher's aide. Were you teaching that as well to the students? Like, what was your sort of interaction like with that book when it first came into your life in that way?
I mean, I was a TA. I never like co-lectured or anything. I was mostly like listening to him lecture. And he was Mr. Rubel, who I think is still, I haven't reached out to. I remember like I've emailed him like a couple times since I graduated high school, but it's been like this many years. And so I would like to think he's still doing well, but he was such a great speaker, and any book that he discussed, he made it all the more engaging. He had like a You see people on Twitter that talk about like if you were gifted and talented and you had a special bond with your English teacher, you're mentally ill now or something. And it's like he was that sort of figure. And he talked about how this book had very not that long ago. I was a senior in 2007, 2008 in as recent as like the early thousands, like 2000, mm-hmm. I want to say, there was like a renewed conversation about the inappropriateness of this book for youth and how it promotes, it glamorizes violence and criminal activity. It just sort of begs to be appreciated by a youth that doesn't fit in or is, you know, our high school had bars. It still looks like a prison when I've driven by it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. There's it's an easy allegory to make the psychiatric institution versus, you know, insert institution here. And there's like a certain relatability to that. And so I found his lectures really entertaining because he was funny. He also showed clips from the film, which is actually pretty loyal to mm-hmm. the book. It's an excellent film. And I think that the combination of humor and like, there's just really great imagery that's written out from the perspective of Chief. And I was a very introverted high schooler and I felt like I could really see myself in mm-hmm. his character and like Billy's character, the stutterer. There's the sheepishness and the shame that they carried that was placed on them like an expectation that they needed to uphold. So, but yeah, and as a TA though, I really was just like mostly sitting there, like any quizzes, I had the red marker for that stuff. Mostly I just was an eavesdropper that made me an appreciator of that book. It's already a great book and he made it that much more engaging. Versus like Invisible Man and The Awakening, that it just those, it felt so dry. And it's not to disparage my actual AP English teacher, but particularly Invisible Man, it's so laden with, and I don't mean this in a, I don't, it's, there's no way for me not to sound like I'm being like douchey or condescending, like, oh, it's just such obvious symbolism. Ness has obvious symbolism. Like the obviousness isn't the issue. It's just, it felt fatiguing. Being in that class, in a test-driven class, in a class where, you know, I understand, you know, to Ms. Faber's credit, most people in her class passed, myself included, you know, because we're taught to, we have to do this very specific type of close reading, but it mm-hmm. felt like we were being turned. It turns you a little bit into like a robot brain.
Yeah.
Having to think in terms of like, what's the answer to the book? What's the, you know, what's the, this and how succinctly can you relay that in Jane Schaefer format? And I don't know, I guess in a weird way, it's so corny, but like I felt that writing about Cuckoo's Nest, which I just felt more passionate about, was like my subtle way of being like, I'm going to be different. I'm going to be more, I'm going to be an individual like Murphy and I'm breaking the mold. They're going to read 1,000 essays on Invisible Man and I'm going to be the one that's writing about Cuckoo's Nest. And such a pick me energy a little bit. But
I think like perfect to what the book is. Like I had never thought about it in the way that you said of like, obviously they're in a literal institution, but thinking of it as you said that of like you can so easily transpose like those dynamics onto like a teacher in a classroom and the person who has mm-hmm. power and the people who don't and how you stand up for each other. I love that you mentioned it being banned because I was looking it up in prep for this. As recently as 2000, it was like under consideration. I don't remember exactly where, but it was considering being banned. And I think someone from like the parents board had written, there was a quote on Wikipedia that was something like, you know, teachers are free to choose what books they want. They just keep picking garbage. But you exactly said like teaching, you know, teaching to the test creates those sort of robots. And that's the prevailing thematic structure throughout the whole book. Is that Chief Bromden, who's the narrator, worked in like an Army Electric group and is talking about how everyone is robots and the mechanics and the machinery and the tubes and the pipes. Mm-hmm. A+, yeah. Great job. Yeah. 5 on the AP. Exactly.
I tried. I was a bit of a snob about that particular subject because it was the best, it was the one that I excelled at the most, you know, and
oh me too, and, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean I was so bad with math, with science, also just with homework in general. So if something didn't really engage me, which again, this book is it was more engaging. You know, maybe it's because certain parts of it are more salacious, maybe because it was a more relatable read. And I like stories about characters that are pushing back against a system. Like, there's something sort of playful is not the right word, but the camaraderie of people like in a rebellion. I mean, like, I like horror movies where characters have to band together to try to survive against like an overwhelming threat that they can't control, like Body Snatchers, or like, I mean, I like Star Wars, right? I mean, that's the most silly, like simplistic example of that. But I like characters that are underdogs or just, you know, the ragtag band of misfits type of deal.
Absolutely. So I've seen the film. I think I've seen it once. And I think I think I slept through a lot of it, which is on me. And I'm like, I think I'm going to rewatch it in like 4 hours. You know, it's coming up. But it is, I think, especially in the film, it's such an ensemble piece, you know, and I think that touches it exactly like you're saying. I think you probably had like maybe one of the best ways as like a high schooler to get the book, in that you're in the class with like no pressure. Like, you don't have to take the test on it. You're not getting called on. There's no sort of stakes, you know, in a writerly sense of it. So you just get to sit back and take it in. And I should have said this earlier, for any listeners, I mean, 8,000 trigger warnings. Like, it's one of the heaviest books. It is. And I was sort of, when you picked it, I was like, thank gosh, I'm so excited. Finally get to read this incredible book. And then I opened it and I was a couple pages in and I was like, oh, my deepest fear in life is being institutionalized. And I didn't think about that as we are here.
That's a valid fear. That's a very valid fear. I mean,
I think there was a Claire Foy movie maybe called Unsane.
Yes, I've seen it. Yeah, that one gets me. Also, Girl Interrupted is a bit more saccharine, the film. I read the book too. There's something very scary about, you realize you're not doing mentally well for whatever reason, you know, or maybe you get a quote unquote 5150 that you are escorted. You don't know when you're going to get out though. Like, you go when they say it's time to go. And it's not necessarily like, how do you measure what sanity looks like? How do you measure what being of sound mind is? And there are a lot of very irritating, triggering, disturbing things that can happen in an institution. And it is very unsettling, the feeling of, I'll just rip the Band-Aid off. I was institutionalized for a couple of weeks in college. It was a bad year. I didn't know when I was leaving. And I checked myself in. I was very depressed. And I checked myself in. There was an orderly. As a male nurse that I got in an altercation with, I found his behavior very inappropriate. And then suddenly they said, well, we're going to keep a hold on you to see how things go. We're going to take it one day at a time, Chelsea. And I was like, oh shit. No. Like, oh, I relinquished like my autonomy in a very big way. And a silly thing too, is that it all had like triggered from like this meat, like they had to measure how much we were eating per meal. Like they had to, like on a, it looked like a children's coloring book page, like on a pie chart, they had to color in how much of our food in a given meal we had actually finished. Which just, again, it's like this standardized, what does sanity look like? What does functioning human look like? Oh, did they eat all the food on their plate? Did they go to bed by 11 without a trazodone? You know, when they were given sunshine time, did they go in the sun or did they sit in the, did they sit under the awning the whole time? You know, they're really like very simplistically. It's very scary and weird that, because then once you figure out like, oh, I just have to go and walk around in the sun this amount of time. I got to eat the X amount of food on my plate and do this thing. If I make my bed every day, they'll see that I'm, you know, got my ducks in a row and they'll let me out. That doesn't mean you're all better. That doesn't mean you're sane. So the measurement, how they measure, I shouldn't say this is a blanket statement for all institutions, but certainly like from personal experience and also very much so in this book, you see that a lot of these measurements are arbitrary, I would say. And not necessarily to the betterment of the individual.
Oh my gosh. And thank you for sharing that. You didn't have to do that. I really appreciate that. But
it's like that personal thing, you know?
Exactly. I mean, just on first blush, it sounds horrifically infantilizing, and that can't help in any measure.
100%. 100%. I mean, it's like, I went in thinking this will be good for me. I'm really not doing well. And then like night one, it's like, oh, you didn't finish your food? I'm going to have to mark that down. I was like,
right.
I don't want to live like this.
Yeah.
I was like, what was I thinking? It was going to be like a spa vacation or something. And, but it's understandable why people in crisis are very reluctant to turn themselves in that way, understandably so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this book is really not that inaccurate. Anyway, that's all my background significance on hence why this book is resonant.
And I think that's such a like a chilling moment in the book when later on you find out how many of the men there are there voluntarily. And it's almost everyone. And there's a beautiful moment in the end with Harding where the opportunity is presented to escape. And he says, no, I want to leave on my own terms. I want to be able to control that and to prove to other people that I was able to do that. But I think, I mean, some of the best characters I've ever read.
Yeah.
Like you said, there is a very much like, whether or not you are sane by whatever definition, to succeed in this location is to follow the rules that are presented.
Yes, yes. You're playing a game. It's also very relatable, the idea of all of these restrictions as comforting. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what to do with yourself outside of being in an institution that tells you when to wake up, when to go to bed, you know, it's like there's a very codependent relationship that comes from that. It takes an ensemble to capture that dimensionality. Like,
yeah, it's a fascinating sort of crossing of paths between McMurphy's trajectory. The understanding is he comes here because he basically wants an easier sort of sentence than being in prison.
He's not wrong.
Well, who can blame him? And it becomes the sort of question of like, is he sane? Is he insane? And I finished it yesterday and I was so struck by the moments where it's first Harding and then later Bromden, where they say everything he did was not necessarily because the nurse or the Combine were telling him to do these things, but he was doing those things for us. And the scenes in which Billy has died and they're sort of deciding what to do with McMurphy, and ultimately he gets lobotomized, where Bromden is watching it happen and say sort of like he's like dead behind the eyes. He has been since he was electrocuted. Those are some great moments. Like when they're returning from the fishing trip and he's looking at him in the rearview mirror. And there's a line, something like, you know, he knows that this is a fight that he cannot walk away from until it is fully finished. This is something that you cannot beat. It just beats you. And it's just a matter of how long you keep going towards it, and that he is on this inevitable path. And it's just like, I think my experience on this podcast is like, the better the book, the harder it is to talk about. Cause I just keep going like, man, that's so good. That's so great.
Yeah. You're so good. Yeah. Yeah. It's a classic for a reason.
I
know. I get that.
So I was looking at, just the Wikipedia pages about this, 20 minutes ago. And it said that Ken Kesey, the author, worked as a night shift orderly in a veterans hospital working with mentally ill VA patients and volunteered for MKUltra to take LSD and record effects and speaking to patients while he was on LSD and wrote everything down and ultimately became the novel, which was wild to me. And then sort of didn't interact with the movie a lot when he found out that the movie was not going to be narrated through Bromden's lens.
It's very like the author versus the director, like the Shinings, the Stephen King, Stanley Kubrick. And I don't know, when you give up control of your baby and how that goes. I mean, it would have been to frame it through Chief Bromden's perspective. And I think in a lot of ways it is in his perspective. You know, I think they do the best to marry that in a way that I think would be easy to follow cinematically. I think, like, for like the purposes of a novel, reading it through mm-hmm. his perspective, it tells one story, and then I think through the other perspective, it's like I feel like there's sort of this baton passing that happens with the film, where you have McMurphy. Well, really, you see the start of the film is like you see the setting pre-disturbance. Right. And then you have McMurphy enter it and how it's been, how it's changed. There's a hole blasted through it at the end, you know? Yeah. And then Chief runs away with the story. I think he kind of, I'm a fan of both works. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was, I think that the trying to film that through the perspective of Chief, like there's these abstractions in how he perceives the world. There's all these exaggerations and the way he looks at someone like Nurse Ratched, it would be almost overstimulating, you know? Yeah. I think like seeing it cinematically and seeing the institution just at first glance, it's just, you know, they're playing elevator music. Everybody's pretty docile. You know, Nurse Ratched, like, she looks perfectly pleasant, mm-hmm. you know? But then when the narrator's describing her, it's like, she was this plastic doll with these huge boobs and her nails and her lips are so red, and like it's a different flavor. I mean, the book is incredible, so is the mm-hmm. film in different respects. I like that you're unsettled, but it's seemingly innocuous what's going on in the in the institution in the film.
I think you're so right. I think there's the language of this was so surprising to me, not just in the story that it tells, but in the way that it does it. The descriptions are so vivid. There is this incredible like tautness to all of it. It is so stressful. Mm-hmm. It is so, and I think it creates, even though it has those really big moments of, you know, walls sliding down and seeing all of the wires and the things that he, I mean, it feels like insulting to call them delusions, but that is, I think, by definition, what they are.
You could say visions, yeah. I guess. You know? Yeah. But yeah, that's what it is. That's what it is. He's not seeing objective reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's like, I feel like it's like too many layers to try to capture that on film. I don't think it would be impossible. I'd be interested to see an adaptation that attempts to faithfully get into the mind of, you know, he's schizophrenic, or he's some form of,
I think the word that they attach to it is schizophrenia. I don't know if like through 2024, that would be
versus 1960s. It would be hard to pinpoint that. I think it reminds me of those drawings that, what artist was it? Maybe not Ken Kesey, but there's some artist that's like, he's on increasing amounts of acid or something. And then he's drawing portraits of himself, and they start to become more and more like outlandish and fantastical looking, and I'm like, I'm imagining like a Cuckoo's Nest film through Chief's perspective. I'm like, would the whole thing just look like like one of those ladder drawings, you know? It'd be like, just, would it be like Yellow Submarine where it's all animated? I don't know.
You're making me remember, there was the book and the movie, and in between there was a play. I don't know if I would ever like want to take on, as an artist or whatever, making a movie of Cuckoo's Nest, but staging that would be so fun. It could really bring some of those things to life. And again, I have like almost no memories of the film. I think something fascinating about this novel, having it be through Bromden's perspective, is talking about the process of white people coming in and trying to build, I think it's a dam in this historic, not like fishing location, but where his community would catch salmon, and talks about his father and this idea of size, of bigness.
Yeah.
Which I think is maybe to me the most incredible sort of discussion that I got out of it was, so looking in Bromden, it's like, how do you, there's an incredible scene where three white people come to talk to his dad about like trying to buy his land or give up his land in order to turn it into this other thing. And these three people, none of them register that this child Bromden is there. And so thinking of it, it's like, How can you not lose a degree of sanity when that is how the world is treating you? You know,
you're being dehumanized, and it's you're immediately questioning reality. Like, wouldn't I be perceived as a person? I am a person. Right. Yeah, I mean, you bring up a great point with Chief being Native American and like psychiatry in general. I'm far from against it. Therapy has been good for me. You know, psychiatric treatment has been good, but it's been a very flawed science for a number of years. And so imagining psychiatry as sort of this, the white scholar coming in and sort of plowing down Native spirituality and putting rigidity to it. And it's like the concrete building on top of the sacred Indian ground, you know, it's very, that's sort of like that on the nose type of symbolism. I feel like I must have said some bullshit like that in my AP essay, but it's very integral to the story that he is easily the most important character. You know, McMurphy's a catalyst, but what Chief is representing and his submission, being rendered submissive, powerful stuff.
He is in the army. I think there's an incredible chapter. I think it's, I wrote it, I was going through my notes. It's chapter 27. But when he undergoes ECT, and as he's sort of coming out of the fog, I mean, it's an incredible experience. But when we go through that with him, it's all through the lens of what he experienced in the army. It's like air raid, and the language in that specific chapter blends. Like, that's where we get the nursery rhyme of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in this game he played with his grandmother. But it's like, it's with that childhood and then working in the army and surviving all of these things. And like, and with McMurphy is whether or not you want to say he's sane or insane. It's like, by the time you go through all of these things, like, it reminds me of that sort of saying of like, to be sane in an insane or like in a cruel world. I don't even know the full phrase, but how can you?
I know which one you're talking. I know the one you're talking about. I also don't remember how it goes, but we both know.
We both get it.
We both get it. Yeah, and then you bring up war and the effects that has. And Nurse Ratched is a nurse from the war. That's her background. And it's interesting to see how, who's to say that she's not, I mean, very arguably more insane,
right?
More disturbed, but she's managed to position herself in such a way that she is able to be the figure of authority when it's purely circumstantial by occupation, by... War corrupts, absolutely. It's a very obvious statement, but I just think about, they both were veterans of sorts, and it's what direction you take from that, or how you channel that. How do you channel those visions or those brushes with violence, and how does that shape you as a person? What is your reaction to it?
It was so striking to me in some of the earliest chapters. I think it's like Nurse Ratched has gained so much authority within the hospital. She is like an award that's like doing the most with the least number of staff or something, which is, you know, really funny and comical. But it's that, like, I don't know, the when I was doing some research into this, I didn't end up looking into it as much as I meant to, but this comes out in 1962. And in the 60s, there's this process of deinstitutionalization, of like shutting down a lot of, mental hospitals sounds bad. What is, like, of different institutions throughout the country and sort of losing funding and things like that. So it's, I mean, by the end of it, it's like, I don't have any concerns about Chief escapes. I don't have any concerns about Chief being out in the world, about Harding, about any of the people. There's, I think Scanlon and Fletcher are epileptic. Like, I don't feel the person that you're concerned about existing in the quote normal world is Ratched. And by the end, she's so far from what she was at the beginning.
Yeah.
That's such a, I had to, there's the scene where, I think Chief says that it's near the end, McMurphy sort of like finally loses it on Nurse Ratched and tears off her clothing and strangles her. And there's a line or something. It's like, until that moment, everyone could have looked at him and thought he was a sane man, until that level of violence comes out of him. And there's sort of no separating that, like we've been saying, from the experiences he's had, from the world he's existed in. But... Yeah. That, I read that and then this morning went and looked and I was like, I don't remember this kind of scene in the movie. And I think I watched it and I was like, it just doesn't. And maybe it's because like he doesn't actually tear at her clothes in the movie, and
Yeah, I'm
that's the
like, how much
thing.
of that is just discretion? So to accommodate, what was Louise Fletcher comfortable with, you know, the
That's fair.
actress? Or would that have been too alienating for audiences? Would they have lost too much favor for the main protagonist? So I think that is valid. Also, again, he's not an unreliable narrator per se, but he does see things in very broad, colorful ways. So
there's a line at the very end of the first chapter, which is so interesting to read, like coming full circle, having read the end where he escapes, he meets a Mexican trucker and starts going off and builds this whole life, where at the end of this first chapter, he's like getting ready to tell us the story. And he goes, but please, it's still hard for me to have a clear mind thinking on it, but it's the truth, even if it didn't happen. Even now, I'm like, I don't know what to do with that, because then it's like, if you want to get really crazy,
it's a
could be like,
great line.
was
It's a
McMurphy
great
a
line.
figment of our imagination? He wasn't, probably. I don't know.
Yeah,
That's like
yeah.
not a reading of the text I'm particularly interested
The real
in.
McMurphy was the friends we made along the way.
Exactly.
I mean, so I think, you know, that is something to consider as far as, like what is truth? I know I definitely remember that being a big, you know, that my teacher or Mr. Rubel reading like that line, and it's like, whoa, you guys, what does that mean? Can we trust him? Can we trust any authority?
No.
No. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's moments like that, and that just those little kind of mini mic drops that he does in the book. And I love there's that little vignette he talks about. It's this character who's like a drunk Santa, basically, coming in, and he's jolly and drunk and this and that. And then he's not. And then he's not. And he's sane. He's quote unquote sane, but he's certainly not jolly. And you could find a toxic takeaway or two from that if you yourself are an addict or alcoholic. But I think in the greater themes of it's simply what society deems as out of sorts. That's what gets you put in. He was perfectly happy and jolly and doing just fine. And then I don't know. There's also the idea of like if Santa did get taken into an institution, you know, he would no longer be a jolly man. The joy would be taken. Christmas would be ruined. You have to have this playfulness about you and your approach to life in order to make living out in the world more palatable, to make life more livable.
Yeah, there's he touches on that exactly in the fishing trip. I don't have the exact line, but yeah, there's a moment where like Chief has injured himself fishing. I think Candy has injured herself fishing, and it's like, you know, there's something about like McMurphy didn't let the pain outweigh the hurt in the same way that he couldn't let sort of the pain outweigh the humor in the same way that the humor couldn't outweigh the pain, because you can't survive the pain without the humor. Yeah, there's so many just wonderful like little nuggets that just, like you said, like mini mic drops that just keep coming one after another.
I love it. And it's like, and then too, with that kind of approach that McMurphy has, he makes me, I also love stories and characters that are like Don Quixote types. They're clearly fighting an unbeatable battle. The odds are so stacked against them, but there's this like unwavering or maybe only slightly wavering determination to do what's right, or to have a good time, just trying to ward off the inevitable darkness that's out there. I like those sort of beacons of positivity. It's the call and response to nihilism, choosing to care and choosing to fight against it, even though, you know, the wheel crushes all. It's like, I think it's very noble. And it makes McMurphy sort of, weirdly knight-esque figure that way. You know,
Absolutely.
what he does for his cavalrymen. You
Yeah.
know,
He comes and says like none of you are beyond saving or beyond humanity or beyond human, and just brings all of that up to the front. And there's so many, like, I think the time I watched it, I did a little summer program when I was in high school at NYU about screenwriting. And so I'm pretty sure we watched this in class as like a just a really tight structure. And it is. And there's like, it's so crisp and succinct. And there's so many good little moments of like small change of, you know, by the end when McMurphy attacks her, there's a moment from Bromden where like he sees a level of terror on her face that means that none of us will ever be afraid of her again. And there are those tiny moments of like at some point Harding hears, I think it's when McMurphy is up on Disturbed, that like he like pinched her ass or something. And so Harding gets a little line in, and it's a little thing here and a little thing there that builds up to this perfect. I mean, there's such great moments of turning. There's those great scenes when they're in group meetings that I think really touches on some of the biggest themes of like tearing everyone down versus standing up for each other.
Absolutely.
When Billy finally gets cornered just before he kills himself, he starts turning. He says, "They did it. They called me names. They did it." Which, God, it's so awful, especially Billy dies. And then someone, maybe it's Martini, turns to McMurphy and says, like, "We don't blame you." And Bromfield says the same thing, like, "We don't blame you." And in the narration, it's like, as soon as I said it, I wish I could have unsaid it. It's just...
It's very emotionally wrenching, that scene. Truly what eclipses all of it is just like the most violent thing is just that moment when Nurse Ratched's like, "What will your mother think?" Just knowing in war terms she dropped a nuclear bomb. I feel like that is really the inciting moment of violence in that scene. It's just knowing someone's vulnerability, knowing all of their vulnerabilities as well as she does. And to say the most, she's not thinking, "Oh, I want him to end his life," but she is damaged at all costs. She does not care in that moment beyond winning. She's so concerned about maintaining her authority, she decides she's going to drop the bomb. And so I think that's the most, I don't know, it's like easily the most devilish thing she does in the whole book for me. Or, you know, she's... I'm sure there's other moments to challenge that, but there's quite a few, but that, it just makes her so like deliciously evil in that way. Not in a gut. She's so just like, he really nailed the wickedness of that level of condescension and control, the utmost extreme of that.
It's control. Yeah. They don't say it often, but they say it a few times of like this game between McMurphy and Ratched. Ratched is always going to win. She always has all the power. She can go home.
Yeah.
She will never run out of cards. Yeah.
Yeah. And in that moment, she just pulls like that desperate act. It's so casually cruel.
Yeah,
just to win, because it's all a game. These aren't real people to her. And so what's the most like devastating real and human thing to counteract that? Well, Billy ends his life, and that's like, oh shit, like the consequences of my actions. And then to go, oh, like what we should do is go about our business, back to your, you know, pretend like this didn't, honey.
Yeah.
That's there's not even happen.
She turns on McMurphy, like as we expect her to do, and she accuses him of playing with human life. And I think at that point, I was like, oh, yeah, maybe like McMurphy has this incredible power. I start like drinking it, you know, I start buying into it of like, yeah, McMurphy is like playing these games with these unstable people and like has gotten them so invested in himself that now, and it's like, no, she's absolutely projecting
and gaslighting. That's it. I mean, this is like the same, like just like the movie Unsane. Or also this happens in Girl Interrupted to a lesser, like I think Girl Interrupted is not the best, unless you want to look at it as more of a contrasting narrative where like the institution actually helped her kind of thing. But like it the idea of being told, well, that's, well, you're the patient. So if you're disagreeing with me, it's because you're being irrational. I'm not the patient. So by default, I am more sane than you because I am not the one that's in the scrubbies or the grippy socks.
The grippy socks.
So anything that you say that is in contention or is against me, well, you're just fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how can you possibly beat a system in that way, even no matter how hard you prove that you are good, that you are sane or what have you? Not that McMurphy was necessarily doing that. He was constantly pushing against it. But it is more or less futile. If you want to play by the rules, you have to become like a robot.
Yeah, like you said, you just have to learn how to push yourself down enough in order to survive until someone... It's so arbitrary. Like someone tacks on this idea that you are sane because you have been able to eat the food on the plate, you know, do.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It really is silly, honestly, mm-hmm. at times, you know, not, and I don't want to disparage how that it has benefited or been a necessity to many people. Now I'm also thinking about Girl Interrupted as well. And I think Susanna Kaysen does a better job of exploring more nuance because in the movie, it's very much, she has a hard time acknowledging or admitting that she's crazy or that she's, you know, what is crazy? And then finally, when she just starts doing what the warden and nurses tell her to do, things start to work out better for her. Whereas the people that are being belligerent, you know, that's kind of serves them right for not, you know, just right. just trying to take their medicine. Whereas in the book, there's much more of a stark turn of like the main character who Winona Ryder is playing her, and it's based off of Susanna Kaysen herself. In the first part of the book, she's honestly acting pretty sane, but she's questioning things kind of like I felt uncomfortably close to the narrator in that because she sort of gets coerced into like accidentally volunteering herself into going in there. She's talking with another doctor and the doctor's like, so you agree you're not doing well? And she's like, yeah, I guess not. Okay. All right. Let's take her away. You know, yeah. And then suddenly, yeah, they're measuring how much food she eats. They can only use plastic utensils. You can't shave without supervision, all this stuff. And then at a certain point, her thoughts get so dark that finally she snaps while she's in the hospital. And then she's like, and then I knew without a doubt I was crazy. And I'm just like, how much of that is the institution just going, you're crazy, you're crazy. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you.
Exactly.
And then you finally, you know, snap. I think my point was something along the lines of how apt that issue is with institutionalized treatment. And that is a prevalent theme in any story that's about it.
Yeah.
You know, especially Cuckoo's Nest is sort of like the crown jewel of those of that kind of story. And it's still apt today.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't want to say it's like the midpoint or something because I would feel like I need to get a calculator out or something. But there's such a devastating moment when McMurphy sort of sees, like understands that Ratchet is the one who decides if he stays or if he goes, and he doesn't want to be here forever. So he decides to keep quiet in one of these meetings when Cheswick is like starting to take his lead, starting to stand up. For those who haven't read the book, Cheswick is this, I want to say inmate, God, patient, who is always
very similar.
Exactly.
It's the irony. He thought he was going to get it easier. It's in many ways worse in an institution. Not many ways. It's that's so not true. I mean, like orderlies are at least they're not known to beat. They're inmates. They're, I don't know. I shouldn't brush with broad strokes like that. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But, well, I guess then it's like, I think maybe the, just like you were saying, like, I'm not touching you, and talking about it being infantilizing, I think like when you are a patient, like you said, everything is like, we're doing this for your own good. Yeah. Where at least in a prison, they don't have that level of artifice. At least in a prison, they're just like, we hate you and you're evil. Exactly. But there's this moment with Cheswick where McMurphy decides, I'm going to play by the rules. And Cheswick, like they go to the pool. Cheswick says that I'm looking at the quote now.
Yeah.
He could understand how he acted and then it was the sharpest thing to do. He told McMurphy this and then he goes and drowns himself. And again, sort of like with everyone saying with the end with Billy, it's like, it's not your fault. Like we all get it. We all understand it, but you were the person who stood up for me and now you're not. And sort of like, if I can't have that one, if that one glimmer of hope that I've ever had is taken away by completely understandable, reasonable means that I would have done as well.
Yeah.
And even just the image of that, he just goes to the bottom of the pool and puts his fingers in the grate and just won't leave.
It's oh boy.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Yeah,
this one was a heavier one. I feel like I hope that
you picked a good one.
You enjoyed and appreciated it and it's good, but it's like, I don't realize, I guess. It's kind of like if I bring up something like going impatient at one point, I'm like, I ought to perhaps be more mindful of the weight of certain subjects, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I'm really grateful that you took to it. And I guess I didn't think you wouldn't, but like, I'm just like, now that we've, mm-hmm. Just discussed it, and I'm just like, man, yeah, this was pretty dense fare, not even for high schoolers. I don't think mm-hmm. that we shouldn't handle high schoolers with kid gloves. I think mm-hmm. this book had a lot of value and was very special to me because I was at that age where I felt that I was not taken seriously, that I was invisible, that I was being told that I'm wrong for having very human feelings and experiences. Yeah. So, you know, there's violence and there's criminal activity galore, parents, mm-hmm. but it still has like extremely high nutritional value just the same.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I think reading it the whole time, I was like, what is her story with this? How did this come into your life?
Not all high schools are teaching mm-hmm. Cuckoo's Nest, that's for sure.
I think a really intelligent choice on a teacher's part, because like you said, it has that great nutritional value, but it's also like sex and crazy people and all of those things that like will make you, I think like the best thing maybe for an English teacher is when your students are in like math class or something and they'll be like, you will not believe what is going on in this book. That must be like a good sign for an English teacher. And I think
And it had personal value to him as well, I think, because he did love Ken Kesey, and I never got into reading his other stuff, but Mr. Rubel, he was also like, he had been in the army. I don't know what war he would have fought in, but he had been in the army. He'd grown up lower class, and the army is what helped him afford to like go to college to pursue academia. And I think that this had that personal resonance. And he's somebody who had like a lot of, who seemed like very like wise about life to me. And I think because he was. And so it was a very like high recommendation coming from him for me to read this, to go and read this book on my own,
right?
You know, even though I didn't have any assignments for, I was just a TA. I didn't have to read it. I wasn't actually in his class. I didn't have to actually do anything for it, but you know, mm-hmm. it carried a lot of, I think, good life lessons.
Oh yeah.
Or good perspective, challenging bits.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this great moment when Chief reveals that he can hear and can speak to mm-hmm. McMurphy. And they have this conversation about bigness, but they also have this conversation, or Chief does internally, about sort of like what makes McMurphy, like why is he the one? You know, why is he capable of all of this? And the line is, he's what he is. That's it. Maybe that makes him strong enough, being what he is, that he's not going to let them twist him and manufacture him. And yet he kind of does. Like, there's also this idea from Bromden of, here it is, I was just being the way I looked, the way people wanted. I don't seem like I ever have been me. How can McMurphy be what he is? I think that was so jarring and like such a, they don't even really spend a lot more time on it in that way. I think there's a moment later where they're in the dorms, they're supposed to be sleeping, and Bromden says he wants to reach out and touch McMurphy. And there's a line where he goes like, well, maybe I'm gay. And he goes, no, that's too simple. That's too easy of an excuse. Like, I just want to touch him because he has the wherewithal to like be himself.
Yeah.
And that Bromden has always sort of been what he has been told to be. And I think that's because like, he's also Harding gets on this great thing about shame in one of the final chapters, in that like final like sort of party sequence of like the great societal finger pointing at you, I think is the line. And it's that like there is no room for individuality, even there is no room to discover what that individuality might ever even be.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. He's the closest sort of representation of it. But yet, as we see what happens by the end of the book, McMurphy cannot live in a world like that. You cannot win. You cannot maintain. If you want to survive, or you want to even thrive in an institution or just in society, you have to conform in ways that go against he's self-assured. Like, I don't know. I've met people in my life who have that seemingly very secure, like strong sense of self. And yet everything around us is always telling us to question ourselves, not outside of us. Don't question authority. Don't question the world and why it's run the way it is. Question yourself. It makes him this sort of, like, I understand that, like, there's this compulsory thought of like, I want to touch him. Like, is he real?
Yeah.
Like, it's like almost sort of that line of thinking, like, is very relatable to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Harding says it first, and then after Billy dies, Bromden says it. But he goes, there's something else that drives people, strong people like you, my friend, down that road. It is us. And I think that's like, I think it's frustrating because, like, we don't know, frustrating but purposeful and like not a criticism, that we don't really know McMurphy outside of the hospital, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know if he becomes it or if he is it, but he sort of becomes the savior. Like, he comes into this group of people who desperately need something to believe in, and he becomes that, whether or not he is beforehand. And like we've both been saying, there's no way for that to survive with these institutional pressures. And then I circle back to, is McMurphy really real? Was he ever there? He was.
I choose to believe he was.
Oh, yeah.
Also, I think he got put in the institution for a reason, because he also, his brazen selfhood, let's say, leading to criminal activity.
Yes.
He was ejected out of society for that.
Exactly.
You know, so it's very believable that he did exist in the real world, the overarching institution of this reality that we're forced to live in. He had to be contained as a result of that. So I think just him showing up gives me plenty of reason to believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That he was doing the same kind of, society does not like a rabble rouser no matter where they are.
No matter where they are. Yeah.
So he goes, so first you send him to the army, and then you send him to prison, and then you send him to the institution. And the institution is the place where they have the ways and means to lobotomize him. And
that's the final stop. And it's that's, you know, you're either gonna get in line, or you're gonna get realigned. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, it's such a devastating spoiler for a book that came out 60 years ago, but Chief suffocates him, and he starts crying and sobbing. And I think it's Scanlan, you know, one of the only remaining patients, says it's such a hard moment. He Chief suffocates McMurphy, and then discovers that everyone else is awake and hears it and doesn't do anything and allows it to happen, and then says, take it easy, like, it's okay, you did the right thing. Someone even says, is it finished? And
for him to have continued living while lobotomized, that's so cruel for them to see him as a daily reminder of, this is what happens when you fall out of line. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it's like, oh, I want to remember you for how you were, not how you are. Like,
exactly.
You know, the longer he were to continue to exist in that state, and day by day, he's just, well, yeah, we used to have fun, and now this is what happens if you fall out. Like, you know, that constant visual, like, understandably, he's better remembered for who he used to be.
They wheel him in on a gurney after he's been lobotomized, and I think it's just three of them circle around who are still there, and they're like, that can't be him. Like, he's, again, they bring up the idea of, like, he's too small. His arms are too small. Like, his you know, they can put tattoos on anyone. That's not really him. That's not really him. And there's some.
They fully like stripped him of his identity. Like he's no longer, he already died. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And the sort of deciding factor for Bromden is he wouldn't have left something like that sit there in the day room with his name tacked on it for 20 or 30 years. So the big nurse could use it as an example of what can happen if you buck the system. I was sure.
Exactly.
It was like, that
exactly.
cannot be him because he would not allow us to see that or allow that even idea to exist.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that, like, of all of the hundreds of cruelties that happen in the book, the absolute certainty is that it was a kindness for Bromden to kill him.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the skewing of reality when things are so out of whack that killing is an act of mercy. To remove somebody from that world is to do them a service. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fun book.
It's an incredible book. Oh my gosh. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
At the end, Bromden, oh, I'm going to do such a bad pun. He flies the coop and.
The cuckoo flew over the nest.
He did. Yeah.
It's just a treat to revisit this because I don't know. I hadn't thought about it in so long. And yet it has been a book that, you know, increased exponentially in its relevance, you know, over the years as I've gotten older. Partly a trip down memory lane, but also partly just a reminder that these experiences that I've had in life or continue to have been well documented and well experienced before me. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what makes stories like this so outstanding. I'm glad that you enjoyed it too. And again, I think if I had had my physical copy, it's got to be in storage. I can't imagine I would have gotten rid of it because it was so special to me. I couldn't find it. I was starting to freak out. But like, then I found my copy of To Kill a Mockingbird and Catcher in the Rye. And I was like, okay, but like, you guys are mocking me.
Yeah,
like,
real ones only.
Mockingbird mocks me. It's a really special novel. I'm grateful for the opportunity to get to discuss it.
Thank you. Yeah. Final question. We've both addressed this. Would you consider it required reading?
I would say certainly highly beneficial reading. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It touches on so much and it's just phenomenally written. The prose alone is so fantastic and it touches so much. It's some of the best characters you'll ever read.
It's colorful but unpretentious. I think mm-hmm. I love that the most about the Kankisi and the way that Chief describes things and experiences them. He's not trying to alienate you. He wants to be understood so badly, but he can only see things the way that he sees things, you know, or he sees things in such colorful ways. You know.
In my experience, I think specificity is the heart of things feeling universal, even if their brand of specific isn't your brand of specific. You'll find things to connect with because it makes that character feel more real. Yeah. And there's always an ability for humans to connect with another human.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the difference between, for me, reading Cuckoo's Nest and not trying to come after Kate Chopin, but I think it was around the time we were reading The Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I mean, how can Cuckoo's Nest just not hit different?
Yeah.
You know? just in comparison. I'm not a woman torn between lovers who walks into the ocean. Spoilers. You know? I'm just a crazy person trying to get by. We all are, right? You know, so.
Yeah, to be sane in an insane world. That's it.
That's right. That's right. Well, I guess actually she walked into the ocean because she was kind of getting, she walked away from her husband, but then the other lover rejected her.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, well, this isn't very girl power of you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything
you'd
like to plug as we round out?
Oh, man. I don't, you know, I make video. I'm trying to make like at least a video a week right now, mm-hmm. get back on the horse with that. That's all I've got going on right now, honestly.
All good.
Yeah, there you
well,
go.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much. This was a delight.
Thank you to Chelsea. I just recorded next week's episode, The Tale of Despero by Kate DiCamillo, with our guest Jess Woodworth. You can support the pod at buymeacoffee.com/requiredreading. Every episode costs about $8 to produce, so any little dent in that is greatly appreciated. No pressure. Thank you for listening this far. And I'll see you next week. My name is Erin Bowles. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. The R stands for radioactive. Isn't it shitty that that one song kind of, whenever you hear the word radioactive, you want to like shout it twice more? There are worse things in the world. Okay. Love ya. Have a good one.